Good afternoon. Oh, it's still good morning, everyone. Is that right? Yeah. And welcome to this really exciting topic about obesity and how the new weight loss drugs, how the insurers can use them for good, life insurers. My name is Margie Kerr. I'm currently at Mercer, and this will be the shortest chairing session ever because I have been told to not read the bios, only say their names. So just from memory, there's Dr. Matthew Paul and Jonathan Blunden, and they're from Munich Re. Yeah, right. This should be a really, really interesting topic. So I'm thrilled that so many people have turned up, because there's also a lot of really high caliber topics on in this concurrent session. So thank you very much. Oh, and very important housekeeping. Questions, we want you to ask them personally with the mic. So we'll use the roving mic. We just, the speakers have said they love engaging with the audience rather than reading through an app. And really, I have ADHD. I'm scared of apps. So I just might not. It's just quicker and more efficient. Works for both. So enjoy, and we really look forward to your questions. And the questions will be at the end. Thank you.
Hi. Oh, sorry. Hi, everybody. We're going to talk about obesity today. Why obesity? It's because it is a concern for society, and it's one of the major modifiable risk factors that is difficult to control. It's a concern for life insurers as well. And there are new treatments available that are getting a lot of media attention, and we want to talk you through that and perhaps discuss some impacts and opportunities. So this is the structure of our talk. Obesity, a background, I'll do that. And then we'll go into the treatments, the current ones and the ones that are emerging and on the market now. And then I'll pass over to my colleague, Jonathan, who will talk through the impacts of these treatments on society and then focus in on life insurers. And then we'll hopefully leave you with some opportunities. But we'd like you to start thinking of opportunities along the way and talk about them in the questions, hopefully. So let's get going. We'll talk about obesity. We first need a definition. I think most people know what obesity is, but this is the WHO definition at the top. It's essentially an excess of fat or adipose tissue that results in negative health consequences. It's generally measured using the body mass index, which is a very flawed way of measuring things. Flawed for multiple reasons. One, the measurement was primarily developed in Caucasian populations. Use outside those populations does require some adjustment, especially when considering the body size categories that are listed below and what category the people may be in. But that's the data for Caucasian populations on the screen. And it's also flawed because it's not a direct measure of fat or adipose tissue itself, right? It's measured or it's calculated by taking your weight in kilograms and dividing it by your height in meters squared, giving you the unit kilograms per meter squared. Once you've got that number, you can then categorize yourself into those different body categories. You've got unhealthy, healthy, and then overweight. And then the obesity categories start at a BMI of 30 plus. And you have three categories of obesity, 1, 2, and 3. And the most severe category is 40 plus. Generally, as a rule of thumb, mortality and morbidity risk increases outside that normal range. It's a bit of a U-shaped curve. And interestingly, for those who like history, the organizations which first demonstrated that relationship were life insurers, which I think is pretty cool. So it's a big problem. And it seems to be getting worse in Western societies, especially, or societies where there is abundance of food and resources. So let's talk about the prevalence. All right. So on this chart here, we have up the prevalence of obesity in adults in three countries, dating back to 1975 and up to 2016. And there's a trend there. And it seems to be going up and increasing in a worrying fashion. Of course, America leads the way, bigger and better at everything. But New Zealand and Australia are following behind. And that is a concern. Obesity is generally considered a chronic and progressive illness. Once it establishes itself, it's very difficult to reverse. So that partly explains that trend. And more worryingly, that we're not going to talk about is childhood obesity, but that's also on the rise. So another chart using different data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare that is a little bit more up to date. This is the prevalence of the adult population in the different body size categories in 2011-12 and 2022. I only want to show this because I want to point out that there is this shift to the right. So not only are more and more adults becoming obese, but the people who are obese are becoming increasingly obese, moving up the different categories into the more severe categories. There's that shift to the right. It would be lovely if we could stop that shift and reverse it, but it's challenging. More on that later. All right, moving on. So what are the risk factors or causes of obesity? I like to say that this diagram is, I quite like it because it represents the simplicity of obesity, but also the complexity of obesity. The top line is why it's simple. It's an energy imbalance. You're taking too much energy in for what your body needs in terms of the basal metabolic rate and the amount of energy you require to burn. So that's the top line. Very simple, right? But when you start thinking about what drives those behaviors, what causes someone to eat too much or perhaps not exercise as much, that gets really complicated. And there are genetic factors, there's physiological and medical factors, medicines, there's psychological and even sociological and environmental factors that all alter these things. And this makes obesity very difficult to prevent and also treat, which is probably one reason why you get that ever-increasing prevalence and that shift to the right. Okay, moving on. I've got to go quickly. So what does obesity cause in terms of health issues? I like this diagram on the left because you've got obesity in the center and it's wrapped around in a layer of discrimination and stigma, which makes dealing with this problem even more challenging in those who have got obesity or established it. And then you have the major medical conditions which are associated with obesity surrounding it and categorized into three broad categories. You know, there are the metabolic grouped, like cardiovascular disease, diabetes. You've got the biomechanical group, which includes like arthritis and, say, obstructive sleep apnea. And then you have got the mental health conditions, which are associated with obesity, including depression and anxiety. So relevant to insurers, there's a list of conditions which cause a lot of claims in life insurance. And obesity is associated with 13 different types of cancer, heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes and the like. So it would be good if we could do something about that. So ripping on into treatments, treatments for obesity have been quite difficult to implement. These are the broad categories of treatments. You've got behavior and lifestyle interventions. That's mostly diet and exercise. Then you have pharmacotherapeutics or drugs. And then you have surgeries, often called bariatric surgery. All right, so as a rule of thumb, the diet and lifestyle modifications or behavioral modifications, they're mildly effective and difficult to maintain. And then you have the pharmacotherapeutics. Those drugs have mild to moderate effect, and the problem is they come with side effects frequently, and when you stop the drugs, the weight usually returns. And then for the surgeries, these are the most effective, but they're invasive. And they're often withheld for people who have the most severe obesity and have failed other treatments and maybe a complication or two as well. So the other thing with them is that they are the most effective, but generally when you have the surgery, you maintain the weight loss, which is good. But they're not really good to deploy at a large scale across a population for those other reasons. All right. So let's just talk about some of the effectiveness of the treatments that are currently available just to give you some perspective. This chart is on the y-axis, you have the average percent weight loss with the treatment. And then you have the treatments with different color coding. Yellow, I hope it turns out is yellow. Yeah. Yellow are the surgeries. And then this greenish yellow in the middle is the medications, the pharmacotherapeutics. And then you have diet and exercise on the right. And as you can see, the surgeries achieve the highest average weight loss, 15 to up to 30%, depending on the severity of the surgery. The medication struggles to get close to 10%, and diet and exercise also struggles to get close to 10%. The box on the right, well, we want to kind of talk about what happens if you do lose weight. Generally, the more weight you lose, you see a change in biomarkers associated with disease, and you've got a list of them there that improve relatively quickly after you've lost weight. And mortality and morbidity also improves, generally relatively slowly, though. All right. Let's talk about, this slide gets complicated, so we'll start simple. We'll talk about the new treatments. So for decades, the hormones that are released when people consume nutrients have been studied, and a group of hormones were identified called the incretin hormones, And two particular incretin hormones were identified, and that was the glucose, glucagon-like peptides and the glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptides. And what was noted when you eat food, those hormones are released and they affect insulin and also blood sugar control. So they were quickly studied in terms of use for diabetes, especially diabetes type 2, and were found to be successful in terms of helping people manage their diabetes. What was observed when people took those drugs for diabetes in these studies, that they also noted that they lost weight. So they were then studied in terms of specific treatment for obesity. How, I guess, the mechanism of action is thought to be that they act on the brain-gut axis. So in the brain, they modify the desire and craving for food and also enjoyment of food. And then in the gut, they reduce stomach emptying. What that result, the result of that is you rebalance that equation. You no longer really want to eat or enjoy eating. And then when you eat, you get full faster. So you're going to take in much less energy, right? And you lose weight. Interestingly, the receptors for these hormones were, have been noted to be sprinkled all around the body, brain, gut, of course, heart, lungs, kidneys, muscles, etc. That may become relevant in a later slide, so just remember that. All right, I'm now going to show the drugs that are available in most markets. And they can be broadly described as, there's two main ones, I guess, semaglutide and tirzepatide. Let's talk about semaglutide first. It's a GLP-1 receptor agonist. There are multiple formulations. There is usually a formulation for diabetes at a lower concentration, and that is Ozempic. And then there is a formulation for obesity, usually at a higher concentration, and that is called Wegovy, right? They're both administered, those two medications are administered via subcutaneous injection, which is not pleasant for some people. So the manufacturer, Novo Nordisk, has developed a oral formulation, but it's only available, and I don't think it's available in Australia, for the treatment of type 2 diabetes. But we expect there'll be developments for weight loss as well. Then there's tirzepatide, which is, I think, a more interesting drug. It is a GLP-1 receptor agonist and a GIP receptor agonist. It has a combined effect. Again, two formulations, diabetes and weight loss. You've got Zepbound. I've got that around the wrong way. So it's, I think, Zepbound for type 2 diabetes and Mounjaro for weight loss. Again, the concentrations are different. Again, they're subcutaneous injections. The manufacturer is Eli Lilly. Now, if I were to list all of the other drugs in the pipeline that are going through various stages of clinical trials or in development, you would have like 15 slides of drugs. There's a gold rush going on here, a lot of money to be made, we won't dwell on that. All right, so how do these drugs compare to other drugs? This is a chart of multiple drugs and the percent, again, on the left, percentage average weight loss, and you just want to call out semaglutide at the weight loss dose is responsible, can lead to 15% average weight loss. And tirzepatide, even better, 21% average weight loss, right? Now, remember, I said before that the surgeries are sort of 15 up to 30%. And so tirzepatide, or semaglutide, and even better, tirzepatide, is heading towards that sort of gold standard of treatment, which is the surgery, but isn't, you know, appropriate for everybody. So the drugs in development, some of them are up to 28% effective in terms of average weight loss. So that's really knocking on the door of the gold standard of treatment, which is quite exciting. So what happens when you take this drug? This is from the Step 1 trial, which is a randomized controlled trial. People with obesity, adults with obesity, were either given placebo or semaglutide at the weight loss dose, and they were on these drugs for 68 weeks. And as you can see, weight falls off relatively quickly and plateaus down to around 15% of weight loss on average. And the placebo group lost a bit of weight because they were supported with diet and exercise modifications as well. What happens? Well, who wants to guess what happens when you stop these drugs? Unfortunately. I forgot my own slides. Side effects. Common ones, around 20 to 40% of people will have these side effects: nausea, vomiting, constipation, occasionally diarrhea. They're pretty common. The rare side effects that are more serious: pancreatitis, gastric paresis, and bowel obstruction. All right, so back to where I was. What happens when you stop these drugs? This is, again, from the Step 1 trial. So remember, they were on the placebo group and the treatment group on semaglutide. on these drugs up to 68 weeks, and then the drugs were stopped in this group. And you can see weight returns, unfortunately, heartbreakingly. All right. And I just want to call out on the right, there is a talk, there's a few studies done on how these drugs perform in real world circumstances, because controlled trials are very controlled, right? People are supported and followed up and everything's monitored. So generally drugs perform better in that sort of circumstance. In real world use, they don't perform as well. And one of the problems is adherence. People don't tend to stay on these drugs when they're prescribed them. And that one study, they found that at 12 months, only 32% of people prescribed these drugs were still on them. That's for a multitude of reasons. Maybe that the side effects are too bad. They don't like the injection. The cost of the drugs. They may have achieved their weight loss goal. And also, if you think about it, if you no longer like eating, and you know food is a very social thing, life becomes a little bit less rich or enjoyable. So some people stop them for that reason. Anyway. I guess one thing for society is if we really want to tackle obesity and these drugs are going to be part of that, what does that mean for people? It means we have to keep people on these drugs chronically or intermittently, or that's a big question that is yet unanswered. All right, moving on. So, I better introduce this slide. Let's talk about morbidity. All right, so this slide is from the SELECT trial, which again is a randomized controlled trial looking at multiple outcomes. There was a placebo group and a treatment group. This is major cardiovascular outcomes. And you can see in the placebo group and the semaglutide group, very quickly, within a matter of weeks to months, there is a separation in the incidence of major cardiovascular outcomes between those two groups. And that is maintained over time. I think they were followed up for 48 months. Right. So that's pretty impressive. You can calculate a hazard ratio from that, and that generally represents a 20% reduction in risk of major cardiovascular outcomes, which is quite exciting. Now let's talk about cancer. There are all these obesity related cancers. Now this chart is unsatisfying to present, but I'll try and explain it. So to determine cancer risk, you generally need a well-conducted prospective study that follows people up for a long time, right? Well, we don't do that. We can't do that at this point in time for various reasons. So these researchers did a retrospective cohort analysis. So this is more observational. And they had to use diabetics who have been treated with these drugs who had obesity as the study group. And they had to compare people who are on glucagon-like peptides with people who are on standard care, things like metformin and other medications. And during the study, they noted a reduction in incidence in multiple obesity-related cancers, right? I call this promising, but not conclusive, right? We'll move on. Let's look at mortality, okay? So in terms of mortality, again, this goes back to the step one trial. Same population. You've got the placebo group and the semaglutide group followed up for 48 months. And as you can see, there is a separation in the incidence of all-cause death that occurs pretty quickly within weeks to months. And that's very interesting. Hazard ratios calculated, 19% reduction in the risk of death, which is pretty interesting. It caused a bit of skepticism because that's a very rapid separation. And when you look at people who are treated with surgeries who often lose more weight, it takes a lot longer to get that level of separation. So it implies either there's something wrong with the study, and certainly they all need to be repeated to confirm things, but it starts to imply that there may be other actions of these drugs that are independent of weight loss. And you've probably seen a lot of media about that, and it's being explored extensively. I'll just say something about that. So certainly these drugs do appear to dampen down inflammation. That has been noted. And inflammation is a driver of multiple conditions, cancers, heart disease, neurological conditions, kidney disease, etc. And the people on these drugs are observed, and this is observational data, right? Are observed to have lower level of these conditions. So there may be a mechanism of action there. It does need to be studied, but there is promise, I think. The other impact that's often talked about are the neuropsychiatric effects of these drugs. These drugs dampen down the craving and desire for food, but people on these drugs who are studied for either diabetes or weight loss have been observed to quit smoking at higher rates, cut back alcohol or stop drinking alcohol, and interestingly, stop illicit drugs and even stop gambling and things like this. So it appears to affect broader neuropsychiatric or craving-related behaviors as well. All right, I've ended my section. I'm going to hand over to my colleague now, who's going to talk you through a thought experiment in terms of impact. Back to you, Jonathan.
All right. Thank you, Matt. Matt called it a thought experiment. I'm going to call it advanced actuarial modeling. We've got three numbers, and we're going to multiply them together. So what we're trying to do here is just think broadly, population level, what could be the impact of these drugs on population mortality? So we'll start with mortality. Like Matt mentioned, we'll move to morbidity, and then we'll talk about what are the potential implications for life insurers. So firstly, percentage of the population who are obese. We're thinking long term. We're thinking about who's actually going to take these drugs. So we're just making an assumption here that the people who will be taking these drugs are obese. In Australia, we've got a 32% obesity rate, and another 34% of the adult population are overweight as well. So just sticking with the 32% obese for now, that one is nice and easy. Take-up rate is much more complicated. At the moment, in the US, you see numbers between 3% to 9% of the population who have had the drugs in the past. The more recent statistics are closer to the 9%. I heard someone say the other day that around 4% of the US population are currently on these drugs, and that's across diabetes and also weight loss. In Australia, probably closer to 0%. We don't really have great reporting, but there are lots of reasons to think that it will increase. So let's have a look at some of those reasons. Ease of use. Matt mentioned at the moment you have to take an injection. Nobody enjoys that, but there are oral formulations coming down the line. Cost. At the moment, there's a supply constraint, which is mentioned there as well. We expect the cost to come down. One of the reasons the cost will probably come down, a lot of the manufacturers have applied to get these drugs put on the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. So we'll probably start hearing results of that toward the end of this year. And then the other thing is the side effects, which affects persistency as well. But the newer formulations of the drugs, we expect to have improved side effect profiles as well. So all of these different reasons, we would expect the uptake to increase. And this, remember, we're talking about long-term uptake. We're talking about people who get on the drugs and then stay on the drugs so that they're not putting the weight back on. At the same time, all of these reasons increase uncertainty. And so to highlight that, we're starting with a massive range between 10% and 50% might end up on the drugs. We don't really know, right? So this is more of an experiment to convince you that it's worth considering. And then lastly, the hazard ratio. So we saw that 81% hazard ratio for mortality in the SELECT trial. Matt called out some of the caveats, but that translates into a 19% reduction in mortality rate for people who stay on those drugs. Again, a couple of reasons to be cautious. So the study result, we need to make sure it's actually valid and do some repeat trials. That was a particular demographic. I think it was older adults, sort of 45 plus. Sorry, if you're 45 plus in the room. Sounds older to me. And then also the newer generations on the other side, those we would expect to potentially even improve this so that we know, for example, tirzepatide is more recent than the semaglutide drugs. We see a bigger weight loss impact. Do we also see a bigger mortality impact? All of those things need to be studied. So again, there's uncertainty. Now, just translating that into three assumptions, we've got 32% of the population who are currently obese. We'll assume that 30% of those end up on the drugs long term. And for all of those people, that they experience that 19% reduction in their mortality rate. So where does that leave us? 32% of the population, 30% of those taking the drugs is around 10% in total. And then that's a 19% reduction in the mortality rates, translates to around 2% adult population mortality rates across Australia. So again, this is meant to be a thought experiment. We're not saying this is the number. We're not saying you should go out there and reduce your prices by 2%. What we're saying is, hopefully you can see that that is plausible. And although there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot more work needs to be done, the potential impact is very significant. So from there, we've talked about mortality, thinking about morbidity. It's harder to do morbidity numbers. So we've just got some things to think through. The first one, like Matt mentioned, 20% reduction in adverse non-fatal cardiovascular events. So we're talking about CBD claims and things like that. Cancers, 13 different types of cancer associated with obesity. Things like osteoarthritis. So these drugs seem to reduce inflammation, even apart from the relationship with being overweight in and of itself, and also being overweight puts extra stress on the joints. So both of those things together could potentially reduce arthritis rates or improve arthritis for someone who already has it. And then lastly, the more interesting one, I think, and the one that I heard the ooh in the room, is the brain's reward center. So people who are currently smoking and vaping and consuming hazardous levels of alcohol or illicit drugs, and even things like gambling, things which can lead to, you know, fatal car accidents and all of these types of poor health outcomes, normally through accidental means, potentially some reduction in those as well in the population. So that's the general population, but now let's think specifically about life insurers. So rather than redoing the numbers, I'll give you a couple of considerations of how we might modify. So the first one to think about is age group. So obesity rates differ by age. You've got the whole spectrum there from all the adult ages, and then we've got that life insurance heartland, which is kind of age 35 to 65. And you can see, if you can just draw an average with your eye, you can see that 32% number for the whole population that I mentioned before. But then within the insured ages, you're looking more like maybe 35%. So a few more obese people. At the same time, the insured population tends to be a bit wealthier. They've probably been underwritten for their weight in the past. They probably, because of wealth and social connections, might have better access to the drugs, and so the uptake might be higher. So there's reasons to think maybe it's higher, maybe it's lower, and the conclusion there is we don't know. And this is where the interesting part comes in. How can you find out? So this is where we move into what can we actually do about this as the life insurance community? How do we measure risk factors in our portfolios? So is there some kind of scalable digital solution that you can implement where customers have an incentive to let you know what their current BMI is, weight and height, all of those. And then once you know, what can you do to actually target those solutions or even other solutions at this group? So that leads us in more broadly to opportunities for insurers. And this is where we really want to get you thinking. And this is the time to start thinking of your questions because we want to have a discussion is across the life insurance value chain. What opportunities do these drugs present for life insurers? So we've already talked about the first one here. So at the product design stage, how do you incorporate some kind of wellness app or whatever it is? How do you build that into your existing wellness proposition to then encourage people onto the drugs, make them aware of the drugs? Can you provide some kind of pathway or let them know that maybe this is something that's worthwhile doing? And if you do that successfully, which is not easy, but if you do, then what does that mean for your pricing? Are there substandard lives who become potentially standard lives? And then in general, for your whole population that's insured, does that reduce the overall claim rate over time? It may take a while to have an effect, but if the effects are like what we've seen in some of the studies so far, it might still be worthwhile. There's a one thing which is more of a risk maybe than an opportunity in terms of the way that we underwrite obesity. So Matt mentioned before that obesity is traditionally seen as a chronic progressive condition. And what happens when it becomes this treatable condition that you can go in and out of throughout your lifetime? So you can imagine a case where, for example, someone might be obese, they start taking these drugs, and then they end up no longer above whatever the threshold is where the underwriter would say that's problematic. And then they go and get underwritten for a life insurance policy. And then, you know, they're experiencing nausea and they come off the drugs and then they end up with the heightened risk. So how do we make sure that our underwriting questions allow for this kind of change in the way that obesity is managed? On the other hand, it creates an opportunity for underwriting as well, because you have got these people who might potentially have been uninsurable before, but then they move into the insurable kind of bracket because there's a reduction in risk there. And also there's opportunities at claim management stage. So if I mentioned before osteoarthritis, if you have someone who's having trouble returning to work because of a variety of issues, including maybe arthritis, if that person were to go on these sorts of drugs, it's very challenging to exercise when you're in that position. But are you able to lose some weight? It may not completely restore that person, but for some of these musculoskeletal conditions, is there an opportunity to get that person back to the level when they can start participating a bit more in society again and maybe return partial return to work or whatever the case is? So those are some of the things to consider. And we do want to throw it back to you. What else can you do? And also, what are the challenges? I'm sure that there are people in the room who've been looking at wellness and how to roll this sort of thing out. We'd love to hear what the challenges you've seen and also what some of the solutions are, particularly around things like uptake. So there we go. That's the end of the presentation. Thank you for listening. And now we'll move to questions.
Okay, who's got questions? Oh, good, right. Okay.
Thank you. That was excellent. And I actually understood it all. So that was good. My question, it's not a solution to anything, but just a question about the wellness site and mental health. So I can imagine if you were to go onto one of these drugs and it was to be effective, you would feel a lot better. But then there's some of the other side effects like the nausea, the vomiting, the fact that you might enjoy socializing and eating out and all those things. So maybe you feel a little worse about that. And then if you do have side effects and you come off it for a period of time and your weight goes back on or a large portion, again, that may decrease your feeling of wellness. So the question really is, has there been, and I do know that it's quite relatively recent, has there been much study done around the mental health measurement, particularly in the US?
Oh, and the that last bit threw me. But there's a lot of concern about the side effects of these drugs, especially when you roll them out to large numbers of people. Just remember that the class of drugs, the GLP-1 receptor agonists, have been around for decades in diabetics, and there are a lot of studies with large numbers of people. And there was a systematic review and meta-analysis, I think, published either last year or this year, which is the best kind of study to look at things. And it showed for the studies that followed people up on these drugs that measured psychological or psychiatric endpoints or outcomes, there was no negative psychiatric consequences of these drugs, increased suicidality, et cetera. In fact, some people tended to improve, especially people with body disorders, people with bulimia, et cetera, eating disorders in general, showed some improvement. So there's that bit, yes, but there is a lot of focus and concern about the mental health side of these drugs, because some people are anecdotally reporting that they are not feeling great on these drugs. And as I said before, if you stop eating and stop drinking, your social life falls to bits and you become a bit miserable. Anyway, but I think that answered your question.
Just, I guess I'm just injecting a note of caution here. And I don't mean to dismiss everything that's been said, but I'm going to refer to one particular downside. It's natural from reading the popular press to assume that when there's a 15% weight loss, that is all fat. However, the statistic that I've read is that it's 60% fat and it's 40% loss of muscular density and loss of bone density.
Yep.
Now, there are obvious risks in that.
Yep.
Loss of muscular density will lead to decreased balance. Loss of bone density will lead to vulnerability to fractures. And so you can imagine as a group of claimants shifting from organic causes to musculoskeletal causes. And it may even get worse because another statistic which I hope I can dredge up accurately from many years ago is that if you consider a female mid-70s who falls and breaks a hip, mortality rate in the next year is 50%. So you're now generating death claims as well.
No, I agree with that last statistic. In fact, in medicine, we have a rule that if you're over 80 and you fall for no reason, there is generally an 80% chance of death within the next 12 months, which is horrifying. It's a rule of thumb in medicine. There's lots of them, you know. Now, back to your first point, which is around muscle mass and bone density loss. Yes, that has been observed, but whether or not what the cause of it is needs to be untangled, because some people may be reducing their kilojoule. I like to use kilojoules instead of calories, the energy intake, and not exercising and not modifying their diet. And if you reduce your kilojoule intake, your body will need energy and it will take it from fat, it will take it from muscle. The bone density one needs a bit of study, but generally if you're also not involved in exercise and things, you'll generally lose bone density as well. So whether or not there is an intermittent effect of these drugs on bone density, I think needs to be studied. But the muscle mass loss could be explained by inadequate modification of diet and exercise whilst losing drug partially. So that's why I think people should be supported. In fact, when you see people who are supported with specific diet and exercise programs, they tend to lose weight, more weight, and also a little bit more healthily as well. I have no idea if I answered any of that, but there's some numbers back at you. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to give you a perspective from someone who's a patient. Every one of those three main things I have done. So I have done the diet and exercise. What the gentleman before me fails to notice is that people on diet and exercise also lose muscle. Generally, I did. When you lose weight, no matter what any one of those three are, you lose muscle in general, even if you exercise. And I was exercising heavily. Doesn't work. And in fact, in my case, made some of my other health problems worse, because I was, starving all the time. It's really bad for your mental health to be hungry all the time and for your energy levels to plummet. So 10 years ago, when I got married, I was 120 kilos. My tummy was out to there. My wife got upset that I didn't fit in the suit that I'd bought for my wedding. I ended up getting bariatric surgery. Now, you mentioned the difference in morbidity and mortality. Bariatric surgery is serious. It knocked me around for several months. And you really are starving after that. I would eat liquid that was about this deep in a cup and I'd be full, because then my tummy would be incredibly sore, because your tummy ends up the size of an egg after the surgery. The other thing that you didn't mention is it wears off. Your body knows how to adapt to things. Your tummy re-expands. 2 years out, no lasting effect from that surgery. So 10 years ago, I started on the first of those drugs, and it was a daily injection. Horrible.
Saxenda, is it?
Yeah, Saxenda. It was a daily injection. Horrible side effects. That was just before I did the bariatric surgery. So I did that for a year and my body adapted to it. Your body adapts to everything. It's really annoying. I started gaining weight while on Saxenda. Yeah. So I had the bariatric surgery. I am now on Mounjaro, the most effective one so far, as you saw in the stats, lower side effects than the others, although I'm now on a very heavy dose. Which does cause side effects, but I'd much rather have that than the other things. I mentioned other health problems. Like many, many actuaries out there, it's not talked about much. I have mental health issues with depression and anxiety. This stuff is superb for that, and I'll give you a causative reason for that, which you've touched on, but inflammation. Body inflammation is both caused by and causes mental health issues. If you can reduce the inflammation in your body, you get a ton of health benefits, both physical and mental. So anyway, there's my perspective from the other side. And I don't mind didn't mind the daily injections. I certainly don't mind the weekly injections. It's done with a pen. It's actually really simple. It's not that painful. It's into your tummy. There's not many nerves there. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah, and that story goes.
And the cost is the really big issue, I've got to say. I'm just glad I'm on actuarial pay.
$300. So I think in Australia it's around $300-ish a month. Is that right?
Double.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Double.
Wow. Okay. So one thing to highlight from that is that individual experiences do vary with these drugs. And I've also read some very upset Americans who have been put on these drugs and failed to lose weight and even launched lawsuits. So people do need to be made aware that individual experiences will vary. Some drugs are more effective for others. Mounjaro is definitely much more effective. Anyway, another question. Thank you for your sharing.
Yeah. Hi. Just picking up on something that Colin was just talking about, that inflammation point. So one thing I've read about these drugs is taken at a lower dose, they might actually be quite effective, not in terms of weight loss, but in terms of reducing those other markers, particularly of inflammation. And the suggestion that was in those articles that I read was it could be almost a drug that's almost taken by everybody at low doses if it's shown to have that balance between not having symptoms but actually reducing inflammation, because obviously that's a big thing that leads to illness and morbidity over time. So I was wondering whether you've read those types of things and what your thoughts might be.
And you work for Novo Nordisk? I'm kidding. So we've heard people say putting it in the water supply is like where it's heading. But so in terms of inflammation, yeah, the response to inflammation does need to be specifically studied, but it is observed at people who are on these drugs for diabetes, which is usually a lower dose, right? It starts at a lower dose and it escalates to a maximum dose, which is much lower than what is used for a weight loss. So yes, the inflammation effect does start at a lower dose. Yep. And it is exciting. Yep.
Thanks for a great presentation. I have a question around cost. And I wasn't going to share my personal experience, but since Colin did, I thought I would do the same. I've struggled with being overweight my whole adult life, but recently have lost 20 kilos and my husband's lost 30. He no longer snores, which means I now sleep. But we looked into the GLP-1s and instead we didn't go down that route. We went down a high protein diet. So every 90 minutes I eat a serving of protein, and I've been doing that very comfortably, very sustainably. My mental health is better. The snoring's better. You know, it's a sustainable way of eating, but it's very expensive. But the GLP-1s would be expensive too. So as well as sharing my personal story, I guess I just wanted to ask the question from a product design perspective. What do we do about cost? Because even if we don't go down the medical route and we do like what my husband and I have done and just change the way we're eating in a more sustainable way, eating protein 10 times a day is very expensive as well. So what could we do around cost?
Yeah. I think one thing is we're talking about this now because it's something that is certainly coming and we can see it ramping up. And one of the big reasons why it's not already here in a huge way is because of the cost, but the cost is coming down reasonably quickly. And especially once it gets on the PBS, I mean, it gets very expensive for the government to subsidize everybody being on this drug. But yeah, the costs are coming down. Places like Japan, it's already like $100 a month or something, which is much more affordable. So I think, what do we do about the cost? I think the cost benefit for life insurers may not work at the moment, but we can still raise awareness. And for some people, the cost benefit is there. So if we can kind of smooth that pathway for those people, that's great. And the second thing is that the cost benefit profile may change quite quickly.
And I'll just add, there was two things. I've forgotten one of them already. But in The Economist, they did an analysis in America, which was if everyone who would be potentially eligible for these drugs was on these drugs, it would cost, I think, $500 billion a year, which is more than what they spend on all drugs, other drugs combined. But that also represents their inefficient healthcare system and how they get rorted for the cost of medications. But yeah, cost is a huge concern. I can't remember the other bit.
Quick one is, have you thought about how actuaries are going to start pricing for this, underwriting or pricing for it? Because if you, let's say, asking the question, are you on one of these medications, and you get your BMI, great, you're in a fantastic range of BMI, so you know you'll be accepted at standard rates or whatever. But then you can have that rebound. You're potentially at the greater risk of rebound if you're partway through that journey.
Yep. So as we said before, the assumption about obesity is that it's a chronic progressive condition that once you have it, you go up, really. So when you're underwrite, if someone is already overweight or obese, expected to go up, that's sort of built in. How do you underwrite for people on these drugs? Well, you have to underwrite for the person in front of you. If they're declaring that they're on medication, you would follow principles, you know, establish why they're on that medication. Very important. Is it diabetes plus obesity or just obesity? How long they've been on the medication? How any side effects? How stable they are? But I guess you're going to have to underwrite for the weight that they are. And like many medications, there is a risk that you stop them and, and you have to deal with that, I guess. Do you have anything to add?
It's a hard one.
Was there a pricing question in that?
Yeah, well, cut pricing and underwriting.
All right, okay. Thank you.
I mean, on the pricing side, I'm not sure if we would start rating by obesity or being on these drugs now, but there's a broader sense of if this does reduce the overall or it improves overall population health, then what does it do? It's essentially another contributor to mortality improvements, right? But could improve morbidity as well. And I think the more interesting question for life insurers, you know, that happens automatically. Everyone looks at their experience and reprices anyway. But what can we do to maximize the benefit of these drugs for our policyholders and also for us? I think there's a really strong alignment of interest there. The question is, how do we integrate this and what are the opportunities to help people get the most out of it? Because that's their health improving is also improving things for us.
Yeah, I think that needs to shift into portfolio management. And as Jonathan said towards the end of the presentation, being a little bit more active and identifying people who are moving into this risk. Obesity is one of the most important modifiable risk factors there is, impacts lots of causes of claim. I think if insurers got much more involved in maintaining the health of their portfolio, improving it, you prevent claims. And I think that's where it gets quite exciting. There's lots of barriers. When we say that, all the insurers say, oh, we don't have access to our members of our portfolio, the advisor controls access, blah, blah, blah. There's lots of excuses, but I think there needs to be some action there. Us stop.
Hi. I'd noticed your analysis there focuses on people with obesity. I just want to say, I think the drug is available to people even if they don't fall into category of obesity. If you're overweight, you go to your GP, you can get a prescription for it. Do you think that the effect of the drugs and availability is potentially more than what you've got there? Firstly, for those who are maybe overweight to start with. And the second thing, just from my personal experience as well, my wife who's on it, just echoing the comment before, it also affects the people around them. So in my case, happy wife, happy life, but obviously it affects... you know, other things like, you know, mental health or, you know, the ability for people who are affected by sleep apnea and that kind of thing. So again, there could be further positive effects.
Completely agree. And if we were to say 45% of the population instead of 32 and then do that into the multiplication, we start looking at more like a 4% impact. But there's lots of uncertainty on how many people are going to get on it. So the numbers are really more of an illustration that this is something significant and you should pay attention. But totally agree with you. It's entirely plausible that people who are just overweight will get on it too.
Sorry, is this working? Yeah. I've got a question about moral hazard and thinking about, you know, for doctors, you know, anyone who prescribes it, sort of from two directions. One is, you know, so I was pretty horrified when I saw pancreatitis as a possible side effect. I mean, yes, it's rare, but, you know, it would be terrible. Is there a way... You know, could say I took it and I was nervous, you know, is there a way that I could be screened, you know, to identify it before it becomes terrible? I mean, I know, anyway, I'll ask that question first.
Oh, yeah. So people who are considering this medication, of course, go through, you know, they should be going through all the counselling about what this involves and the side effects, et cetera, informed decisions. And then when they started, they do some pre-screening, right, to make sure you're generally okay. And then you should be started at a low dose and slowly ramped up. And during that time, you should be monitoring or being monitored and reporting your side effects, right? And then hopefully if you get anything serious, it won't continue to develop. Because generally, as you increase dose, the risk of side effects increases. So you start on them slowly. So that should help manage that question. And also...
What about pancreatitis? Doesn't that only become obvious at the late stage?
You can see it develop, yep. But certainly you wouldn't want to get full-blown pancreatitis.
Yeah. So you could identify earlier.
Yep, okay. You certainly can. We would want to start slowly and see how people tolerate it. Yeah, you don't want to start them on the maximum dose I think the major risk there is around gastric, because it slows gastric emptying, it slows gastric motility generally. You get the constipation in that, and then also the gastric paresis, which is, I think, less pleasant than pancreatitis.
And related, because I said there are two directions, when I was sitting listening to the retirement incomes part this morning, my brain made a connection between this, and I thought, well, you know, say you could afford it while you're working, and then when you stop working, you just have to go off it. So, you know, that would be pretty tricky unless you want to budget for it as part of your retirement incomes plan.
Yeah. So this is where the government or the people who, the funding of this drug needs to be determined. And that, there's a lot of work to do there in terms of cost benefit analysis. Because not everyone's going to meet the criteria. They're going to set criteria in terms of access. So it might be that you have to have a BMI over whatever X. And you have to have one or two complications of obesity. That's how some markets are introducing it. So it's not just a free-for-all. Everyone gets it subsidized. And then there's the group of people. Currently, it's all sort of been prescribed, I guess, outside the PBS, which is why it's expensive and in some ways variable in terms of what is charged for it. So hopefully the government will take action. They'll do the necessary analyses, work with the drug manufacturers to get a decent price, and then set criteria and prescribing guidelines, you know, manage the onboarding of people and support of people and
offboarding.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Any other questions? I mean, I've got another one, but I want to be, you know, share. Okay.
It was just related to mortality improvement. So from previous graphs, it seems like obesity might have been a drag or reduced mortality improvement in the past, given obesity rates have increased. Should we be thinking about obesity any differently to other causes of mortality improvement? Like, do we think it's going to be a larger, you know, is that why it's more topical, or, you know, there's a range of reasons why mortality improves over time? Yeah.
I think this does represent a very sudden and particular change. And as Matt mentioned, obesity is one of the kind of main drivers of health. And we have an expanded version of this presentation, which talks about that more. But yeah, so I think it's a reason to think in the short term, or maybe in the next 5, 10, 15 years, we do see this movement in population mortality a little bit. It's almost like the introduction of seatbelts in a way, right? We see this sudden shift because of a sudden shift in this very major cause of mortality and morbidity. And so, yes, I think we should consider it separately, how much impact that actually has on our specific assumptions that we set on mortality improvements in the short term. I don't know, but I think it's certainly worth being aware of.
Yes.
Okay. Any further questions? No? Just following on Mark's question about underwriting, I'm just wondering how soon will it make it into like group insurance, you know, voluntary underwriting, into underwriting engine rules, you know, when the question says, what medication are you asking, taking, you put it in, and then do you get all these reflexive questions about it?
If you're asking about medications and someone's on medications, would...
this particular one.
Yeah. But they would have to say yes and then disclose it, and then I'm sure rules would be built around it, probably around why they're on it, and the effect and how stable. And who knows? There's what I want to know at the time of underwriting, and then what is practical. Like, I want to know everything, and then what is actually implemented is a much smaller set of questions anyway. So I'll leave it there.
All right. I think it's time to wrap it up. Thank you so much for being such an engaged audience.
Thank you.
And you're engaging speakers. So thank you very much.